أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله الذي لا يبلغ مدحته القائلون ولا يحصي نعماءه العدون ولا يؤدي حقه المجتهدون الذي لا يدركه بعد الحمم ولا يناله غوص الفطن ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين على عبد المعيد الرسول المسدد المصطفى الأمجد المحمود الأحمد سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد صل على محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين صاحب العصر والزمان خليفة الرحمن إمام الإنس والجان ولعن الله وعداهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله وقوله الحق. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الذين قالوا ربنا الله ثم استقاموا تتنزل عليهم الملائكة ألا تخافوا ولا تحزنوا وأبشروا بالجنة التي كنتم توعدون. صدق الله العلي العظيم. صلوا على محمد وآل محمد. صل على Imam Hussein, the embodiment of resistance, is our topic. Tonight is lecture number 3. Last night, we began our topic. We talked about the concept of resistance in Islam. We talked about the idea that in Islam, resistance equals victory. We looked at various ayat of the Quran, and we broke down the verse that I read for you every single night in the khutbah, that talks about the fact that those individuals who claim, قَالُوا رَبُّنَ اللَّهُ, who say that our Lord is Allah, ثُمَّ اسْتَقَامُوا, and they persevere. They don't leave the path. They stay on the path. They are focused on the path. These are individuals that what? تَتَنَزُّلُ عَلَيْهِمُ الْمَلَائِكَةُ. These are people who can expect angels to be descending onto them, telling them to have no fear, don't grieve, and we bring you good news of what? Jannat that's been promised to all of you. These are people who have resisted the urge sometimes to follow a path that is easy, that's majority. Where the herd is going, I'm going as well. To resist that path and go down the path that is of haq and of truth is no doubt victory. At the same time, very, very difficult. We mentioned last night how Imam Hussein, and we'll go through it in more detail today, how he truly resisted the pressures around him in Medina and Mecca that were calling for him to not go towards Kufa. He had very minimal support. And from those he expected support from, he didn't get. And from those he didn't expect support from, he received. I want to share with you one hadith by Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam. We tried to establish last night in our initial discussion that this path of resistance is a very difficult one. All of you, I'm sure, fight this path every single day. And we'll explore that, as I mentioned, the next 8 nights now that I'm with you. We'll explore the idea of resistance and resiliency on the path of Islam. We'll look at resistance outside of us on an ummah level. We'll look at resistance inside of us on an individual level. And look at the effects. What do you need to build resiliency inside of you? What factors stop us from being resilient? And finally, this inner resistance, when we get to those special nights, those crucial nights of the 8th and 9th of Muharram, those are when we talk a little bit about the inner resistance. Because really, as we enter this discussion tonight, and I promised you last night that we'll talk a little bit about history tonight, and paint for you the picture of how Imam Hussein resisted what was popular, what was majority during his time, and how we can take those historical facts and bring them into today's world. History has a funny way of repeating itself sometimes. Situations arise, the same situation arises over and over and over again. And sometimes the frustrating part is that even though there have been groups before us that have gone through exactly what we've gone through or are going through today, we refuse to learn from their mistakes, or we sometimes refuse to simply emulate their successes. When Amir al-Mu'mineen is giving his last will to his son, he's saying, look, examine and study the lives of those who have gone before you. Look at what they did right and emulate it. And look at their failures and avoid it. When the Quran talks about the idea, فَصِيدُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ فَانْظُرُوا كَيْفَ كَانَ عَقِبَةً مُكَذِّبِينَ, travel the earth, walk around, open your eyes, فَانْظُرُوا, open your eyes, and look at the aqibat, the conclusion, the final destiny of those who have denied Allah. Individuals that the dunya has showered its blessings on. Individuals who have completely denied Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, lived like kings in this world. And how did they end up? And the Quran is pleading with us to look at history, follow history, examine history to ensure what? That we don't make those same mistakes. But sometimes those same mistakes between every ummah is repeated over and over and over again. Our sixth imam talks about this very idea of resistance being difficult in a very beautiful way. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Muhammad. He says, inna min haqiqat al-iman, surely the reality of faith, أَنَّا تُؤْثِرَ الْحَقِّ وَإِنْ ذَرَّكَ عَلَى بَاطِلْ وَإِنْ نَفَأَكَ. Beautiful tradition. Beautiful tradition. Allah Akbar. He says the reality of faith is what? That you prefer, you choose, you select haqq, even though it might be detrimental for you. Even though it might ask you for a very, very expensive price to be paid. Even though it might ask you for the grandest of sacrifices from you, you always select haqq. Over what? Ala batil wa inna nafa'aka. Even though that path of falsehood might have an apparent benefit to you, you leave that path and you select the path of haqq. It's a very difficult tradition to digest. Always on this path of resistance, there's always been a few. The path was made for a few. The successful have always been a few. And even today, there's a handful of people who are keeping humanity afloat. If it wasn't for this handful of either countries or governments or policies or people, as an ummah, as a nation, we'd be destroyed by now. And that's all it takes. That's all it takes. It takes a handful of people with the sincerity that they need, and Allah will do the rest. But it's not an easy path. If we examine the atmosphere, the climate politically, when Imam Hussein got wind of the fact that Muawiyah now had broken his treaty against his brother and made his son the next Khalifa, it's very important that we learn lessons from this. And history is always dry. It's a khushk mawzu. And we do our best to make it enjoyable, but sometimes it's not. It's okay. History is there, not to entertain you, but to educate us. Subhanallah. I've never had a subhanallah for history before, but thank you very much. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. We should know, and we do know, and I pardon, please pardon me for those of you who know this history already, but for my kids, maybe it's brand new information. When this treaty was signed between our second Imam and Muawiyah, one of the conditions of that treaty was what? That the moment that your Khilafat is over, you hand it back to the Ahlul Bayt. Correct? And for 10 years, from the 50th of Hijri when Imam Mustafa was Shaheed to the 60th of Hijri, Muawiyah was in control and Imam Hussein was present. He could not do anything out of respect for the treaty of his brother. But the moment that this individual left this world and made his son his successor, the treaty was broken, of course, and Imam Hussein had no other choice but to rise up. The Ummah, the nation that surrounded Imam Hussein, and the individuals that at that moment were consulting with Imam Hussein. You'd be surprised who was involved in that consultation and what advice they would give our third Imam. You see, the first thing that Yazid did against his father's wishes was he sought out the bay'at and the allegiance of four individuals. Abdullah ibn Abbas, number one. Abdullah ibn Zubair, Abdullah ibn Umar, and Hussein ibn Ali, alayhi salatu wasalam. Durud hijri Muhammad wa Muhammad to this. Even though his father had told Yazid, look, you can do whatever you want, just don't ask bay'at from Hussein. Let him be in Medina, leave him alone. Don't rock that boat. It's going to be your destruction. But Yazid, in his ghurur, his stubbornness, his ego, he says, no, I'm going to prove that I will get the bay'at even of Hussein's. News broke out now, of course, to Imam Hussein that Yazid is a Khalifa and he's requesting your allegiance. As many of you know, he was doing his Hajj when news of his assassination attempt was brought to him. He changed his niyat and left Mecca on the 8th of Zilhajj on the 60th of Hijri. And he met with different various groups. Now let me say one thing here before we continue, and I'll break off from history and come back to history, and just follow me tonight, inshallah. We should understand that these letters that we have heard about since day number one of hearing about these discussions, about these letters from the people of Kufa, numbers that we've heard from the 20,000 to 18,000, the lowest amount of letters written to Imam Hussein that I have read personally myself, and others might have read something else, was 12,000 letters. 12,000 letters in the span of 13 days were written and sent to Imam Hussein. We hear that and we move on. I want you to digest that for a moment. That's a lot of letters that are being written. It's a factory of letter writing. They're pounding out letters by the dozens. And some say all night long they would take turns in writing different letters. Different tribes would write different letters. The head of the tribes would tell these people, look, if you're inviting Imam Hussein, make sure you're ready for his arrival. And we know enough about history to know that at least we know this much, that they weren't ready for his arrival. They weren't ready for Muslims' arrival. Forget Imam Hussein's arrival. But can you imagine now 12,000 letters, a batch be ready, sent with the messenger, knocked on the door of Imam Hussein, dropped off letters, would go back, pick up more, and drop it off, and this process would go on for a couple of weeks. You can't ignore that many letters. Imam Hussein, of course, does what others had done before him, and he sent, of course, an ambassador to go find out what the state, of course, in Kufa is. And Musab ibn Naqi was sent. 12,000, Sheikh Abbas Qumi narrates, became 18,000 at the door of Muslim, giving bay'at. Muslim writes a letter, Imam Hussein, these people are ready for you, come, and they're waiting for you. And the rest of it, of course, you know. So now when he's realized the situation in Kufa, he consults with various people. He has meetings in Mecca, and then of course when he leaves in Medina, he has also various consultation meetings, trying to gather a little bit of support for this movement towards Kufa. Now you have to understand that at that moment, you know, there was this propaganda, of course, that Imam Hussein's father was responsible for the death of the third Khalifa. So places like Yemen, places like Hijaz, were individuals and groups that didn't support Amir al-Mu'mineen and believed that he was responsible for the death of the third Khalifa. So naturally, they turned their back on Imam Hussein. When he was in Mecca, when he moved to Medina after Mecca, he had a very important meeting with these three individuals that I talked about, the Abdullahs, all three of them. And this is really where I want you to understand what's happening. The four of them, with Imam Hussein, sat and had a meeting to do what? To consult about what's going to happen in Kufa. And people gave different opinions. Imam Hussein said, look, this is what I would like to do. I've received letters upon letters from people of Kufa. I want to go and I want to at least hear them out, if not lead them towards the right path. Very, very few people supported this. But perhaps the most disappointing of the individuals was Abdullah ibn Abbas. He sat there and he told Imam Hussein that, Mawla, with all due respect, if you're asking me for my opinion, I would stay here in Medina. I would continue with your dars and educating your family. I would do your best, of course, to guide the people of Medina and focus your attention really in this corner. Don't give bayat, of course. We won't either. That's fine. But don't go to Kufa and rock the boat there. Let him do what he's doing. He's been made Khalifa. He's Khalifa. That's fine. But to go there now and to rise up against him, to speak out against him, to unmask him, to unveil him to the masses, with all due respect, you don't have the numbers for it, don't have the support for it, and really it's a failed mission. Who is giving him this advice? Abdullah ibn Abbas. Who is he? Understand who he is? Let's derive lessons from this story. Abdullah ibn Abbas is a revered companion in both the Sunni world and the Shia world. The first mufassir of the Quran that's a non-ma'asum. The very first individual outside the Ahlul Bayt to do tafsir of the Quran is Abdullah ibn Abbas. A direct shagird and student of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Day in and day out, he was sitting and eating and talking with Amir al-Mu'mineen. Had a very important role in Imam Ali's government in Kufa. Imam Ali, when it was time for the war of Nahrawan with the Khawarij movement, he sent Abdullah ibn Abbas towards the Khawarijis and said, look, talk to them. Ask them what they want. That's how much trust Imam Ali had in this individual. Now, you would think that an individual who sat and walked and talked, spent day in and day out with Amir al-Mu'mineen, he would perhaps learn a little bit of the philosophy of resistance, uprising, the idea that we don't take oppression lightly, that even if I'm one person on the path of speaking out against injustice and tyranny, I will speak out. And yet Abdullah ibn Abbas is the one telling Imam Hussein what? To go with the silent majority. The silent majority knew exactly who Yazid was, knew what Khandan he belonged to, knew who his father was, knew who his grandfather was. And yet nobody, at least not a large enough individual group, said anything. And someone like Abdullah ibn Abbas is telling Imam Hussein to do what? To just go along with the silent majority. If they're quiet, you be quiet. If they're in Medina, you be in Medina. This idea of you coming out and chanting and speaking out and saying he shouldn't be Khalifa is a failed mission. Don't do it. There's no point in doing it. These are not individuals, by the way, who have their imam in ghibat like we do. They're not. These are people who have the imam hadir with them every single day. That's the scary part. That's the scary part in history. You would think for a moment, oh my God, these people must be a little bit blank in their head. If I was there, I would not hesitate for a moment to stand beside Mawla Hussein and say, Imam, whatever you say, I'm there with you, beside you. We oftentimes we wonder, oh my God, if I was there in history, I would do this. How can it not be so open? How can they be so blind? How can they not see day and night, black and white? Why is there not power on and power off? Why is there some confusion, a gray area? We should thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that we didn't exist in those times. I'm sorry to say that. We should also thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He's giving us an opportunity today to back up our words. If we believe that the people during Imam Hussein's time should have thought a certain way and acted a certain way and followed him a certain way, then we are also today, presently, during Imam Hussein's time. The Hussein has changed. The situation has not. He was present. He was hazir. He was ready to go into battle. Our Hussein is in ghaybat. Our Hussein is dependent on us to prepare the grounds for his arrival. And the scary thought is that we think about 18,000 letters. We think about, oh my God, those are a lot of letters. And not one individual was left with Muslim ibn Aqil. The Masail that you recite on the day of Arafah for his Shahadat is very popular. We know exactly what happened to Muslim. He's gharib Kufa for a reason. He was left completely alone. Tanha, nobody, not one person there. Roaming the streets of Kufa looking for a drop of water. When somebody asks him, who are you? He says, have you heard of Ali ibn Abu Talib in Medina? I'm part of his family. That's how gharib Muslim was. What happened to 18,000? If it was 25, 30, 40, 50, doesn't matter. That's fine. Thousands upon thousands are left at a drop of a hat because Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad comes and what? Threatens them with poverty, with hunger, with thirst, with their lives. Went to their mothers and their wives and said, look, if you want your sons and your husbands to have a good life, if you want to be able to pay the bills, ask them to leave the path of Imam Hussein. And they did. The biggest number that we have for Imam Hussein's army, what's mashur is what? 72, of course, that's mashur. The biggest number I've read is 130. 130 from 18,000. And that's not even all individuals who write letters. Allah then came with Imam Hussein from Mecca. So, what, half? 65 people of the 18,000? And the scary part is that we often think, oh my God, if I was there, if I was there, if I was there, you're there today. You're there right now. The same way they had a responsibility to follow their imam, we have that exact same responsibility. They had letters, one after the other, after the other. We have what? Du'a Faraj. We have Ilahi Adamul Bala. We have Wa'ajjil Faraj after every salawat. Those aren't letters, those are the letters of Kufa. These are the letters of Kufa today. Every single time we ask the Mullah to come, hasten the reappearance, send the relief, send the faraj, that's a letter asking the Imam for help. Whereas we have succeeded and superseded 18,000 letters already, begging the Imam to come help. Wa'ajjil farajun, please Allah, hasten that reappearance. You have a plan in mind, Allah? I know you have a plan in mind, of course. You're the best of planners, but I want you to what? Speed up the process. Bring him here. They were begging Imam Hussein to come. We are yatim, Mawla. We have nobody, Mawla. We don't accept him, Mawla. Nothing like this. We have to start thinking about and acting the way the people of Imam Hussein should have acted. We have to start thinking like that and acting like that and giving bay'ah to our Imam like that. You'd often wonder, how can it be possible that people will leave Imam Hussein's side so easily? You should ask the same question today. There are people who are leaving the path of the Imam very easily. A little bit of fame, a little bit of fortune, a different passport, and they're gone. The name's changed, the hair is gone, the hijab is off, everything is gone. And yet we still say, wa'ajjil farajahum. We still write letters from Kufa. It's scary. But it's gatherings like these that make it possible for us to do what? Now do Islah. And reform ourselves and change ourselves. If the people who were beside the Imam day in and day out can have such a shaky iman, where when it came time to uprise against the Khalifa al-Waqt, someone like Abdullah ibn Abbas, who has immense knowledge, he faltered, he slipped, he gave the Imam the wrong advice. And the Imam says, I say tuff on you for this advice that you give me. As long as there is a heaven, as long as there is an earth, I will never accept this suggestion. That I sit in Medina and do nothing, while someone like Yazid ibn Abu Sufyan, ibn Muawiyah, is the Khalifa of Islam. We often wonder, why did Imam Hussein go? What other choice did he have? Sit at home and accept this? Not possible. And there were countless people from his own tribe, his own family sometimes, telling him, don't go, Mullah, don't go, Mullah, don't go, Mullah. And he resisted that path. He went against everybody. And he chose the path that was the most difficult path of his life. He took his children, he took his women, he took his companions, he took the nearest and dearest with him because that's all he had. Now do you understand why we elevate the Ashab so much? Why we say there is no other companions like that of Imam Hussein? In that environment, in that atmosphere, for them to say Labbaik, Ya Hussein, is very special. It's very unique. Because the purpose of Imam Hussein was a very difficult mission. The Ummah, in a very short period of time, had changed so drastically that Imam Hussein had no choice but to literally divide his mission into two. Let's examine what those two pieces are. And again, let's come back to present day as well. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Each time I come to Masumin Center, the clock is on that wall. Today, they put the clock on this wall. So tomorrow, they put the clock right above my head. I got the message loud and clear. We'll do our best to wrap it up as soon as possible. I'm waiting for a buzzer system to buzz off every time I go past 59 minutes. But inshallah, that won't happen. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. We must stop and wonder what happened. How did Yazid become Khalifa? How did Muawiyah become Khalifa? These are individuals who have nothing to do with Islam. These are people who belong to a tribe and a father like Abu Sufyan, who was the staunchest enemy of Rasulullah. During the era of the second Khalifa, he sent Muawiyah and Yazid, who was also his brother. Muawiyah had a brother named Yazid and a son named Yazid. And the one thing that these two could do, they could lead an army. They could fight. They were masters of propaganda, of course. They convinced the people of Sham that Salatul Jum'ah is to be recited on Wednesdays. And they would say, okay, but the name of the namaz is Friday. Anyways, that's how masterful they were. So Umar, of course, sent these two individuals to go and conquer a place called Shamat. Shamat was an area of four different countries, present day. Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. A huge area, which was mostly Christians. Follow me for a second now. Which was mostly Christians. Muawiyah went there, conquered that area, and began to, of course, convert people towards Islam. And as a prize, the second Khalifa made him the governor of that area. Okay? Now, you can imagine for a moment that people of Sham, who have really had no exposure to the true Islam, their only exposure to Islam was who? Was Muawiyah ibn Abu Sufyan. The teachings of Islam were taught to them by this individual. So now when we hear about these stories of this qafila entering the bazaar of Sham, and the Shamis are throwing rocks at them, and insulting them, and ridiculing them, and swearing at them, we often wonder, how is that possible? All they were told was, this is a group that has traveled from Medina and Mecca to come and uproot your Khalifa. That's all they were told. And they know from Muawiyah's time that, look, one thing you have to do is keep the Shamis in the palm of your hand. He told Yazid in his will that, look, whenever you see an uprising anywhere in the Islamic world to try to uproot you and your government, send the Shamis to go. Conquer that and then send them right back. Don't let them go anywhere else. They'll soon find out that the version of Islam that I gave them isn't the true Islam. They were completely and absolutely uneducated about the true principles of the deen. They heard about a prophet in Mecca. They heard about this Islam thing in Mecca and Medina, but of course they were Christians. The message didn't have time to reach there. Okay? That's a group that's uneducated. The people of Mecca and Medina, however, that were of course fully aware of what Islam is, knew exactly who the Prophet of Allah was, knew exactly who the Ahlul Bayt were. The Prophet wasn't, you know, it wasn't a secret that the Prophet of Allah loved the Ahlul Bayt and elevated them every chance he got. And yet, like I mentioned yesterday, when Imam Mustafa was made the Imam after the Shahada of Amir al-Mu'mineen, his Ashab let him down. His ashab weren't strong enough to uphold this pressure from Muawiyah. And so, of course, this sulh happens. And when the sulh happens, Muawiyah now goes from the governor of Sham to the Khalifa of Islam. And the people of Mecca and Medina sit there quietly and let this man now take control. And you wonder, what are you doing? It's not like you're the people of Sham that you don't know. You do know. You witnessed the Holy Prophet. Some of your parents sacrificed their lives for this mission. And you sit there dormant, asleep, completely indifferent, because you don't want to get involved in the political movement of the Khilafat. So what do? You remove yourself away, you pray your salat, you fast, you give your zakat, everything. But the Khilafat, the leadership, that whole business is not my business. So I sit here silently being the majority, allowing someone like Muawiyah, the son of Abu Sufyan, to now be the Khalifa and the representative of Rasulullah's path. Before we continue, if I can ask all you to please move a little bit forward with one loud salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad, please. There's space on my left here as well, please. If you guys can move a little bit forward here. Thank you. Thank you, Jazakallah. Thank you.
Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Nare Henry.
Yali. So now you have these two different groups. Follow me, I don't have much time left. You have these two different groups. The moment Imam Hussein begins his mission, you have one group who is asleep, dormant, allowing someone like Muawiyah with their knowledge to become Khalifa. The other one is ignorant, unaware, no idea what's going on. As far as they know, the Ahlul Bayt are Muawiyah and his sons and his brothers, because that's what he taught them. And Imam Hussein now is tackling two different groups. Do I awaken the ones who are asleep, or do I make aware the ones who are ignorant? I want you to start using your minds and, you know, get those cranes going inside of your minds about today as well. Do we have two groups as well? Are there groups that are unaware of Islam? Are there groups that are dormant and asleep about Islam? I don't know. When Imam Hussein begins this mission, he realizes that by me shedding my blood, I can awaken those who know who I am. Right? Because again, the Shamis will think, oh, this man named Hussein came from Medina and Mecca, tried to uproot our Khalifa. He came, he was killed on Karbala. That's it, story finished. But the people of Mecca and Medina, the Arabian Peninsula, of course, knew who Imam Hussein was. They witnessed the Prophet of Allah, you know, hugging him and kissing him and holding him and saying Hussein minni wa ana min Hussein, all these things that we've heard. They've all witnessed it. They knew exactly who Imam Hussein was. That's why Imam Hussein time and time again would say, do you not know who I am? Umar bin Saad, do you not know who I am? Even in his last moments on Thil Zainabiyah, Bibi Zainab says, Umar bin Saad, you're watching Hussein go through this and you're quiet. You know who Hussein is. just so nobody on the day of judgment would ever sit there and say, we didn't know that that was actually the son of Fatima. We had no idea. Imam Hussein would introduce himself. In fact, it was the sunnah of every single one of the army members of Imam Hussein to enter the Maidan of Karbala introducing themselves. Ana Ali ibn al-Husayn ibn Ali ibn Abu Talib, for example. This is who I am. So maybe there might be one individual who might think, wait a second, what are we doing here? This is the Bani Hashim. This is the beloved of our Holy Prophet. That's why if you look at the khutbas of Bibi Zainab and Imam Sajjad in the darbar and the courtyard of Yazid, in the presence of the Shamis, look at them and what they say. It's beautiful how they present themselves. Imam Sajjad on one end doesn't talk about Yazid and what he did on the day of Ashura. He simply introduces who the Ahlul Bayt were. He starts off by saying, if you want to know who we are these qualities. We are these qualities. I am the son of Medina and Minna, the son of this and this. And he introduces himself so people will know who he is. And Bibi Zainab doesn't say a word about the Ahlul Bayt, sits there and unveils the disgusting face of Yazid in his own courtyard. She looks at him in the eye and says, inside of you, the offspring of Shaitan is being bred. And together what they're doing is, not only are they making the people of Sham aware of who the Ahlul Bayt are, but also making the people of Sham aware who Yazid is as well. And so while Imam Hussein with his blood awoke those who were asleep, it was Bibi Zainab in the courtyard of Yazid that made those who were unaware aware. How hard this path is. How difficult this path is. And every step of the way, Imam Hussein was told, don't go down that path. This path is easier. This path is easier. But he chose the path that was less traveled. Because that was the path of Haqq. It was detrimental for him, no doubt. It was a huge price. But as I mentioned in the very beginning of the lecture, Imam Salih says, even if that path for you is what is zarar, you go down that path. Because the path of falsehood, it might be at the moment beneficial. The Quran says, إِنَّ بَاطِلَ كَانَ زَهُوقًا. In the essence of falsehood is its own destruction. A nice snake on the outside, beautiful, beautiful, smooth skin, but spraying venom at you and killing you from the inside. Historically, Imam Hussein was all by himself. He had a handful of people. Those individuals who wrote those letters to him were individuals who were nowhere to be found. There were individuals, my brothers, can you imagine for a moment? There were people who actually traveled to Karbala with Imam Hussein. Because, you know, Imam Hussein would, when this movement now and this news had spread that he's going to move towards now Kufa, he would approach people, groups of people. Not that Imam Hussein needed help. He was giving them an opportunity to earn your Jannat. On the night before the day of Ashura, he has a secret meeting with who? Umar ibn Sa'd. He says to Abu Fazl, summon him by himself. No Hurmala, no Shimr, I want him and him alone. And those two sat in the tent on Shab al-Ashur just by themselves and discussed. And Imam Hussein said, look, I'm letting you know that if you plan to do with me what you want to do with me tomorrow, there are consequences. There are consequences. I'm letting you know that the blood that I have in my veins and the blood these people have in their veins, it's very valuable in the eyes of Allah. Think twice before you do anything. There's still time now. Not that na'udhu billah Imam Hussein wanted to spare his own life. Are you kidding me? Imam Hussein gave Umar ibn Sa'd his last chance. So he would never say that nobody actually informed me. And it's quite interesting. And we'll talk about Janab al-Hur, I believe, tomorrow. But the morning of Ashura, Hur has a talk with Umar ibn Sa'd. Now, can you imagine for a moment, Umar ibn Sa'd has this lengthy conversation with Imam Hussein. And he had the entire night to mull over what Imam Hussein said to him. You don't think the words of Imam Hussein were echoing through his head? Of course they were. You would think that maybe he might consider changing the plan on the morning of the day of Ashura. When Hur comes to him and says, Umar ibn Sa'd, there are 30,000 of us, there are a handful on those side, what's going to happen today? He says, I'm going to kill Hussein. He says, you're going to actually go through with this? Hur never for a moment thought it would come to this. He thought, okay, they would come to some agreement, some conclusion, some sulh of some sort. For sure he never thought that this blood would be shed on the plains of Karbala. For sure he never thought that Umar ibn Sa'd was that blind that he would kill Hussein. He was shocked. He says, you're going to kill Hussein? He says, I have to, Hur. I have no other choice. And what took Umar ibn Sa'd an entire night to come to the wrong conclusion, it took Hur 30 seconds to come to the right conclusion. When he found out from Umar ibn Sa'd what's going to happen, he grabbed his slave, he grabbed his horse, he grabbed his son. He said, I'm going towards heaven. And he walked towards Imam Hussein. This is Umar ibn Sa'd, who has known Imam Hussein since he was a child. This is Shimr ibn Dhul-Joshan, who was on the Sina and the chest of Imam Hussein. The same Shimr who fought beside Imam Ali in the war of Siffin. Against Muawiyah. This historical piece in history gives us a couple of lessons. Number one, don't take your iman for granted. Don't assume that I'm on the path, I'll stay on the path. The path requires you to constantly be resilient on that path. There'll be attacks coming from all sides onto us. We have to be able to repel those attacks. Don't take it for granted. Don't think, oh, I have love of Ali. I have love for Hussein. I know Imam Zamana is. I'm a Shia. I'm good. And let your guard down. These were people, like I said, who up and down with the Imam, lived with him, talked with him, walked with him, woke up with him, ate with him, everything. And yet when it came time for Imam Hussein, he's actually suggesting to Imam Hussein, don't rise up against Yazid. Stay in your corner in Medina and just do your thing. These were people, of course, who traveled with Imam Hussein, like I mentioned, in that very difficult journey from Atais 28th Rajab to 2nd of Muharram. It's a very long journey. And you see the akhlaq of a person. Imam Ali says, what if you want to know somebody? Travel with them. These are people who are now traveling with Imam Hussein. How could you not be completely drawn towards this man? How could you not want to give your life for this man? And yet we see on the 8th of Muharram, there are individuals who come to Imam Hussein and says, Mawla, doesn't look good right now. There's thousands on that side. There's a few of us here. If it's okay with you, I'm going to go back to Medina. You know, made it all the way to Karbala. Days away from being the Ashab of Imam Hussein. 2 days from Ashura. He didn't resist the urge to go down the path. That was easy. Today, equally, we have two groups in this Muslim Ummah. One is completely unaware of what's happening. And one is dormant and asleep. They need awakening and they need awareness. And if the people in Pakistan, if the people in Iraq, if the people in Afghanistan, the people in Yemen and in Syria right now are playing that Husseini approach where they're giving their life to awaken the masses, we have the Zainabi approach in the West where we make those who are unaware aware of what's happening. No one's asking you to bear arms and sacrifice your life and shed a drop of your blood. No one is asking you to do that. Within the confines of the law, make those who are not aware aware. Speak out, stand up, rise up, and resist the path that the herd is going on, and choose the path of those that are less traveled on. This is what's called victory. Because the truth is that for us to sit here and have the luxury, and it is a luxury, to listen to the dhikr of Imam Hussein and recall all those events that led to his grand sacrifice, that came with an immense price. A number of people gave their lives for you and I to be sitting here in our luxury. In very difficult moments. I talked about last night, the moment that Imam Hussein left Medina. How difficult that ruksat was. And tonight, a little bit, I want to speak about that moment that as he's leaving Medina, he stops at two graves to say his khudafis. You know, tomorrow, inshallah, we begin the musibat of the ashab of Imam Hussein. Then we get, of course, to the family of Imam Hussein, and then, of course, the day of Ashura. This connection that Imam Hussein and his mother Fatima Zahra had. Of course, mothers and their sons, it's very well documented that if daughters are for their fathers, then sons, of course, are for their mothers. And I'm not suggesting that there was any sort of favoritism with Sayyidah Fatima and, of course, Imam Hussein. She loved her sons equally. But history and certain moments in history tell us that there was a little bit of a special attraction between these two. When the event of the Shahadat of Sayyidah Fatima happened, and I don't want to read the whole Masail, but I don't have time for that. When she was brought back from the masjid after being hit with the door, and she went to Asma bint Umais, and she said, Asma, I'm going into my room right now, and so long as you hear the dhikr of Allah in my voice, know that your Shahzadi is in this world. And the moment that dhikr stops, know that inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Fatima enters the room and she begins her Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, dhikr of Allah. And there comes a time when that dhikr stops. And Asma calls out, Ya bint Muhammad, O daughter of Prophet Muhammad. There's no answer. Ya bint Muhammad, there is no answer. She calls out a few times, there is no answer. She enters the room and they're lying on the ground. Of course, it's a lifeless Fatima Zahra. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. She kneels down. She kisses the forehead of Fatima. She says, Shahzadi, send my salams to your father when you see him, please. Asma walks out of the house and the very first people that she meets is a very young Imam Hussein and a very young Imam Hassan. Imam Hassan looks to Asma. Asma's face, of course, is dropped. Imam Hassan says, Asma, Aina Umnaha? Where is our mother? Where is our mother? Asma doesn't say a word, turns around and enters the house. These two follow Asma inside the house. They get to the room. Imam Hassan sees his mother, his lifeless mother, lying there on the ground. They begin to cry. Imam Hassan now moves towards the body of his mother, kneels down and begins to cry. But Imam Hussein was different. Imam Hussein's reaction was different. Imam Hussein stopped where he was. Looked at the lifeless body of Fatima and said, Ya Amma, Ana Hussein. Ya Amma, Ana Hussein. Amma, it's Hussein calling you. Almost as if to say that there's never been a moment where I call you, Amma, and you don't answer me. This is Hussein now calling. This was the same Imam Hussein. Then when he's leaving Medina now to go towards Kufa, he stops off at Rasulullah's grave. And like a soldier, like a warrior, walks towards the grave of Rasulullah. Says, Nana, I'm leaving now. I'm going towards Kufa to save your ummah. And very, very few times in history have we seen moments of weakness from Imam Hussein throughout this mission, from when he left to his shahadat. Very few moments. But one such moment was after he left the grave of Rasulullah, he now made his way towards the grave of his mother. And the way that he walked towards Rasulullah's grave was a man on a mission, stern, strong. But with the grave of his mother, he was stumbling towards the grave of Fatima, almost as if this young child who hasn't seen his mother in years, the door opens, the mother walks in, and that child runs so fast towards that mother that he's stumbling. That was the stumbling that we saw with Hussein. He stumbled towards the grave of his mother, said, "Amma, I'm leaving now. Amma, I wish if you could take me inside the grave with you. You won't be there. Baba Ali won't be there. Bhaiya Hassan won't be there. Nobody will be there. I'm leaving now alone. Keep me in your du'as." But Hussein didn't realize that a mother's heart never leaves her son. There came a moment where he was reminded that his mother has been with him every step of the way. Asri Ashur, in front of him is Bibi Zainab. He's about to enter the Maidan of Karbala. When he's about to leave, Zainab says, "Hussein, Bhaiya, I have an amanat for you from our mother. My mother told me that Zainab, when my Hussein puts on his old libas and makes his way towards the Maidan of Karbala, stop him and give him my amanat." What is that amanat? She moves forward. She kisses the forehead of Hussein. She kisses the neck of Hussein. She kisses the chest of Hussein. She said, "Bhaiya, when Amma said that when my Hussein goes to the Maidan of Karbala, kiss that forehead, that when nobody had swords, when nobody had arrows, they would throw rocks at my Hussein's forehead. Kiss that neck, that Shimr bin Dhul Joshin on Asri Ashur, 13 times with a dull knife would remove the head from the body, and kiss that chest, Zainab, that chest that 10 different horses trampled my Hussein on." سيعلم الذين ظلموا أي منقلبين ينقلبون إنا لله وإنا إليه راجعون. مات من حسين يا حسين يا حسين.